Let's start out with the fiscal package. So pre-Georgia, the talk was maybe we get 1.2, maybe get a trillion. And now we got 1.9. We've also had it coterminous with the vaccines being widely distributed and getting distributed faster than expected. And so I think what, and then furthermore, Biden is on the tape this last week saying he wants to go big on infrastructure, something like $3 trillion. These are numbers that are just hard to fathom in our lifetimes anyway. When you have such an enormous fiscal stimulus, how do you think that will end up impacting both the bond market and then, you know, the equity markets as well?
You know, sorry to go back to this and saying, we've got to think about what's new, right? I mean, you said that basically the Georgia thing was a little bit of a surprise, so you had a little bit of an increase there. So is the market not discounting the size of the infrastructure package or further stimulus? So if we get a surprise and we start to see that the package is either front-loaded or that the traction or the pace of growth increases, I think the question really becomes, can the market look through the short-term inflation prints and growth? And I still point back to the fact that it is the U.S. We're still tethered to real rates and to economic activity globally. So, you know, some of the things that people point out to is, oh, God, you know, look at airline tickets or post-COVID. And we may even see some double-digit prints and one-time adjustments in price level to certain sectors. But I don't know if we can really push this longer term to say trend growth is really going to shift up way above that 2 to 3% range, or longer term inflation can be sustained rather than just a one-time price level. I'm not saying we won't get volatility as the market romances that, but the base case right now, just given what we are tethered to, doesn't seem like it's going to be uncontrolled, but more rate vol if you start to get, you know, more surprises on fiscal side or in terms of traction on inflation.
You talked about volatility and dislocation. I guess if someone at the beginning of the year had priced an option, implied volatilities for the 10-year note probably would have been around just 50, 60 basis points. And let's just say that's 50. And then if someone said, well, what would be the volatility for the next, for the first quarter, that would be half that, around 25 basis points. And yet you said that we had a 25 basis point move on one day in February, and we had a total move of 75 basis points in the first quarter. Why do you think the volatility was so much greater? And going back to the Saddam captured analysis, who cares if the volatility was so high? Why do we want it to be an orderly change? Why not have a discontinuity? And what will that mean if it has the sort of volatility as it spills over into other markets?
Larry, good question. I think for stability, we want some volatility. We don't want large moves, you know, that cause systemic risk. But if you think about it, if you don't have volatility, you may get crowding, you may get investor concentration. So that complacency that you get could create, you know, frothy asset prices and asset bubbles. So I don't think, you know, low volatility is sort of an objective function that's great for financial stability. But in terms of, you know, going back to, you know, how much volatility, you're right. One of the things as a risk manager I look at is you look to say, is volatility higher than you would expect it or what's being priced in? So that means the amount of risk that you take, you need to scale back a little bit, right? And what we've seen in, for example, if we look at equity markets, VIX for most of the first quarter was trading in the mid-20s and almost 30 at certain times. Now, that's also slipped back. That's one indication of volatility. But in other pockets, like, for example, in the bond market, what we had was not only did we have a slightly higher level of volatility, but the actual realized volatility, you know, what you saw, as you said, in terms of these one-day moves or a period of moves, was higher than what the insurance market or the option market priced in. So that's kind of a warning sign to saying, hey, you're getting some dislocations. Price discovery is not as clean as it should be. So one of the questions I always say is this a market that's going to be facing tail risk or very broad-based risk or air pockets, as people try to transfer like one set of bonds or one type of risk to another buyer that has a different valuation framework. And we've seen this volatility within sectors across equity market, across emerging market currencies, and across different parts of the yield curve.
When we first started our careers at Salomon Brothers, I'm thinking particularly of January 1994 when there was a regime change at the Fed. Fixed income markets went a little crazy, and when they did, it sort of disrupted certain players that had carry trades on. In particular, I could think of Orange County that went bankrupt because of their over-reliance on their long position in intermediate long-term rates. Do you see other, if we do have a fundamental repricing in the yield curve, do you see massive disruptions as it relates to specific financial institutions or other buyers of fixed income instruments that have bet the house that rates would remain low?
Yeah, carry is a drug, Larry. I mean, if you think about a lot of the deleveraging that's occurred, not just in 94, but other places where even, you know, before the great financial crisis, a lot of the carry trades is people leverage up to get higher returns. And when I think right now, if you're saying, are you seeing a lot more carry in the rate market itself? You know, I don't know for sure, but as I scan around, you're not seeing as much as you would anticipate. You know, because, for example, a lot of the carry in the 90s was in the mortgage market. Where right now, a lot of the purchase and larger participants in the mortgages has been, the dominant player has been the Fed. If we sort of look back and think, are we, if the market gets too complacent about how much interest rates can move, then they'll start taking longer term rate risk and just funding it short term. Haven't seen it yet, but doesn't mean you can't be cautious about that complacency. So, you know, one of the questions people ask is, does the Fed care if rates rise, or, you know, will they do something? And that gets back to, does that rise in rates affect financial conditions? And when we say financial conditions, hey, does it affect the economy, the ability to borrow money, right? So they look at whether it's corporate spreads or the equity market, and the dollar itself, does it relate to currency vol and other factors that's causing people to reduce or be able to not borrow credit. So if you have a sharp move in rates that's disruptive to financial conditions, I would expect that you might get some response from the Fed if they have their current stance. However, my thinking is that if you have a rise in rates that's associated with growth or growth expectations or even inflation expectations, it's not a bad rise in rates, and it could actually act as a governor against some of the other speculative moves.
Just to think more globally for a second, one of the interesting aspects about the world is that we all don't respond to the vaccination programs at the same pace. Mm-hmm. Israel is leading the pack. U.S. is doing pretty good. Europe and Japan are not doing very well at all, and that will, I imagine, slow down their rate of recovery. But at some point, the Japanese and the Europeans will be vaccinated, in which case that'll be a nice kicker coming out of this. Do you think that, how do you think about the context of slow European and Japanese growth, how that affects near-term fixed income markets?
Fixed income markets, if it's global growth, yields should sort of move not in tandem, but in relation to each other. And what we've seen is that most of the move in yields has been, like as you said, in those countries, for example, the U.S., even the U.K. or Australia. It's not the only cause. You know, like I said, there's other factors affecting rates. But I would say that if the reopening is slower, then you would anticipate that monetary policy, prices, et cetera, would remain muted, and those yields would not get back to anywhere real. And then for the audience, we're still sitting on 10-year Bund levels, the German government rate, at negative 30 basis points, negative 35 basis points, and 10-year JGBs at 8 basis points, very close to zero.
Incredible. All right, Sudhi, thank you very much.